Welcome to the Live Courageously podcast show, episode 82. I'm your host, John Duffy, and Live Courageously has been the conscious theme of my life for the last 3 years since the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, and an unconscious theme for most of my life. Courage is resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not the absence of fear. There's something contagious about someone who is courageous. And today's show is with a friend and guest, Robin Hamm, who has lived a very courageous life. He's an award-winning director and writer, an Army combat veteran, and an alumni of the USC MFA program. Robert grew up in Los Angeles, joined the Army in 2007 as a combat documentarian videographer. And during his time in the military, he served a combat tour in Afghanistan in 2009, 2010 as a paratrooper, airborne, and then deployed to over a dozen dozen times to various areas in the Pacific, India, Thailand, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, the Philippines. He's received the Department of Defense Military Videographer of the Year Award 3 times and then left active duty in 2014 and remained in the Army Reserve until 2017. He remains the most award-winning military videographer in the post-9/11 era. He now owns and operates a service-disabled veteran-owned production company called Hammer Productions, and he's worked with various companies such as Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, the Veterans Health Administration, the Department of Defense, We Are the Mighty, and Veterans TV, and worked on various projects with talent such as Tom Hanks, Michelle Monaghan, and Joe Mantegna. He's won 4 Emmys and has been nominated for 6 more. In 2016, Robert was named a Pat Tillman Foundation Scholar and was honored at the 2023 Super Bowl as an honorary captain. In 2022, he debuted his first feature documentary about his late wife's battle with cancer and their journey called Made with Melanie. Robert's second feature documentary, Interpreters Wanted, about Afghan interpreters, with won the Founders Choice Award at the GI Film Festival and Best Documentary at the Arizona International Festival. That's just a whole lot, and there's a lot more, and I'm just giving you the short version. So with that, let's welcome greetings, Robert. Thank you for joining me and joining us on Live Courageously.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you for that illustrious introduction. I appreciate it. Very humbled to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you, man. And it's been a while, and I'm glad that you were able to make the time to be part of this. Because, I've been tracking some of your work and I got a chance to watch your documentary, and we'll be talking more about that. But just to start off, I always start off the show because most of the people who have been on my show I know personally from the real world, not just from the social media world. So my first question is, how did we meet, if you remember? You know, what was brought us together and how did we cross paths?
Oh, man, I'm glad you asked that because I was thinking about that. And so long story short, and I tend to make short stories longer because I'm a storyteller. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, and I kind of felt like I lived on the other side of the tracks of Hollywood. My dad and my mom kind of came to Los Angeles from Michigan, my dad from Dallas, and they converged in Los Angeles, both pursuing film. My mom went to CalArts. My dad was a musician. He was playing with Cher at that time when they got married and everything. So I grew up in the Valley and wanted to be in Hollywood, like as early as I could. And my dad, later on, after I'd gone to college and everything, he introduced me to a fellow musician that he had been playing with, Martin Gigi, who is a mutual friend of yours. At that time I was trying to, this is like, after high school, I was grinding, production assistant, extra work, just doing anything I could possibly do. And my dad didn't know anybody in Hollywood, but he knew Martin. And he was so kind. Martin was so kind to me and let me do, I did a production assistant on one of his first couple films and interned for them for a little bit and just always supportive. And I think that's how I got your information. And then we had lunch and I was just curious about your experience and what you were doing in Hollywood and your work. So I think that was a long story, but there you go.
But it was a great story because Martin Gigi is one of the best on every level, man. Just a talented musician, talented music producer, director. And then of course, basketball player, because I played basketball with him on and off for the last 10 years. So, and the fact that, it's funny how life introduces you people. And he, of course, you got introduced to me and you were a military vet, and I was doing, as a civilian, I was doing all kinds of stuff to support military vets in Hollywood. So it just kind of like came together. So it was a very cool introduction.
You knew, you made the flag with George, right? And I knew him too from some veteran circles. And we knew each other through some other circles too, I think.
Veterans in Media and Entertainment, or it used to be VFT. And then I directed the flag, which was at the GI Film Festival years ago. So I kind of just, you know, I had done some stuff with the Marine Corps as a producer, line producer. And then that opened up a door and I said, okay, what can I do to help veterans in Hollywood? And it became a passion of mine. And so we kind of ended up, you know, in different similar circles together, me and you. Obviously you as a Army veteran, me as a civilian. So, but very cool, man. And well, my second question, and you know, you've had a journey of many types, and courage is so many different things. It's big things, it's little things, you know, courage comes across in little moments and giant moments. And so I always ask people what live courageously means to them, how do they interpret it and see it in their life?
Wow, that's a big question. I've always been, I guess, unironically, considering that I've wanted to do Hollywood my whole life, I think a major source of my inspiration was watching, you know, those heroes on movies, you know, Saving Private Ryan and Braveheart. You know, those were the movies that I grew up with and the cult in the coming of age years of my life, and watching these, you know, mythological characters doing things, but living in a way that was kind of what I was searching to live, living honestly, knowing that, like, pursuing a purpose in my life, trying to do what was right when it was, you know, set in front of me. Life isn't always kind of like black and white. You get to make this decision or this decision. It's like going right or going left. Maybe either one is not wrong or right in this moment, but you have to kind of, I'm not like just follow your heart, but there is a part of that. Follow your gut and follow your heart on the values that kind of you have. And I've kind of just always been that way. And I think sometimes it's gotten me into trouble. And sometimes I think it's also helped me to navigate some really difficult, complicated things that happen to all of us in life. You know, I just never gave up. I think that was a big thing that has been said a million times before and we'll say again. When you fall, you just get back up. And that's kind of what I've been trying to do. And then obviously I'm a, you know, I believe in God, and I very much, you know, hold on to that faith through some really hard times. So.
Well, we're going to get into maybe some of those times with you. And like you said, never give up, because, you know, you don't know what life is going to throw at you, and it throws a lot at us. Some of it we like and a lot of it we don't like necessarily, but we got to keep dealing with it. Right. So you've had those moments in your life. But going back to your early part that started you making a big choice, a big decision, you know, your family's in the entertainment industry, your dad's in the music industry, and you make a decision as a young person to join the military. Well, that wasn't, you know, it wasn't like everybody in California at your age made those kind of decisions. It was a little bit, you know, a small group of people, I would think. It's not like an area where joining the military is the thing to do. What made you make that decision at that point? What drove you and why?
I think at the time when I joined in 2007, it probably came down to two simple factors. My job situation was very volatile, and I had gotten married and I wanted to take care of a future family. And 9/11, that which had happened, you know, 6 years previous, I had turned 18 when 9/11 happened, and it just changed my perspective on the world and what my involvement in the world was going to be. So I think those are the two things at that time. Like, looking back, I think that there's a lot of things. I was very politically interested in what was going on. I was very curious about the wars in the Middle East and the West's conflict with, you know, various sects of Islam, and why 9/11 happened. And, you know, I studied abroad in Israel couple of years before I had joined the military. So I had seen kind of the front line of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I kind of just, I am a patriot. I believe I love this country. And, I remember getting in a fight with my very anti-war uncle, who I love, and he was rightly so to be anti-Vietnam War from my perspective, because I think Vietnam War is something that was a very horrible time for our country for a lot of different reasons. But he was very not pro-Bush at that time, and I was more on the right at that time. And we got in this big argument, and I told him, and we're very good friends, I love him so much, but he said, well, if you believe in these wars so much, you should just join. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to join. That's the stubborn asshole that I was. So.
Wow. But like you said, it impacted you. I know for me, it impacted a lot of people in this country, 9/11. You know, for me, I was, prior to that, I had been on the far, far left. And so 9/11 was a turning point for me where I kind of reevaluated all my beliefs, all my positions. And I say that after 9/11, I became a born again American and a patriot, really for the first time, because wow. It just made me shift gears and look and go, why was I thinking this? Why did I believe this? Why was I on this side? And I went through that reevaluation and I just said, okay, you were wrong about this. You were wrong about this. You were wrong about this. And I saw all the ways that I believed that I was wrong. And then I changed. And so it wasn't a quick and easy change, but it was a change. And then I moved in a new direction. So like yourself, wow. You know, it wasn't like I could, I was past age to join or anything, but it was that impacted, and it impacted so many people for all kinds of different reasons. But so you made that decision. You were, like you said, you're a little bit of stubbornness, a little bit of patriotism, a little bit of history, knowing from going to Israel, understanding some of the Middle East, which a lot of people, obviously most people in America, don't really understand it and don't have the up close understanding that you even got once you went in and went to Afghanistan. You got another level of deep understanding. And I got that from watching your movie. But tell us about that. Tell us a little bit about the journey. So you make the decision, you go. And then tell us about that, what that journey is like.
Yeah. I've shifted a lot in my political beliefs. I'm all over the map, actually. And I think that kind of we all probably are more than we like to think, especially during an election year. But I went in very pro Iraq war, as an example. We knew enough about Afghanistan that I kind of was ambivalent, I guess, as a 24-year-old about Afghanistan. I believed in the weapons of mass destruction, and I thought that this was the conflict because of the domino theory of what was going on in the Middle East. And by the time I joined in 2007, which was like towards the middle to end of the surge. And I did. So then I went to basic training. Then I went to advanced individual training, which was at the DINFOS Information School at Fort Meade, Maryland, which is kind of like a military art school. All like the artsy weirdos that couldn't get into art school who wanted to get some GI Bill stuff, all end up at this school. Video, photo, graphic designers, everything. It's a great hodgepodge of this. Felt like military outsiders too. Huh. And then I went to airborne school, and then I got stationed in Alaska with the 4th Brigade, 25th Infantry, which was like, they were the newest airborne brigade stood up in the military, who was basically built for the Iraq war. And they had, by the time I had gotten up to Afghanistan in 2008, they had just gotten back from an extended Iraq tour from 12 to 15 months. So these guys were tired. And I think the first film, long form film I made in the military was about a company that made some major changes in Iraq. I got their footage and I put together a film. It's on my website and everything. It was the first film I ever made for the military. And I felt a little guilty that I hadn't signed up earlier to get to Iraq. But that was not my journey. We were kind of refitting and everybody was getting trained and a lot of people were moving out of Alaska and coming back into Alaska for a deployment that we were about to have to Afghanistan at the beginning of 2009. And we would basically be the tip of the spear airborne brigade on the border of Pakistan for the President Obama's surge that he started once he became into office. So he was elected in early January 2009, and instantly it was like, we're going to do a surge of soldiers. And we were the first brigade, along with other brigades. Obviously there's other units all over the border, but you know, so I basically followed this. I was one videographer and in an airborne brigade of 3,500 soldiers. We were in charge of four provinces in Afghanistan, and I just went all over. Yeah, just there it is. So we were at this base called Fob Salerno and in Khost province. And that's where we, you know, I went on over 100 missions, all over, airborne missions, night raids, spent time in the hospital. That's my officer, Major Gregory, who is an amazing leader and a good friend. I still keep in touch with him. And that was my partner, Andrea Hill, Specialist Andrea Hill, who was my photographer partner. And we'd get our missions and I'd go out and film and do stories, and she'd go out and do photos and do written stories. And we're still all very close.
Well, you know, what, just for the moment, so you end up over in Afghanistan, and what was that like? I mean, you had been to Israel, you had been, you know, to that part of the Middle East, but, you know, your first in this world is so different than our world. And, you know, you're working for public affairs, you're a videographer, you're doing that, at, like you said, for the military, the only one out there in that situation. What did that feel like? I mean, on all levels, I mean, feeling scared, feeling overwhelmed, trying to like build relationships. And you obviously started to build those relationships with the Afghanis. Tell us a little bit about that journey into that world.
You know, I probably, everybody who goes to war has their own unique experience. I think mine is unique in a couple different ways. When you're in public affairs, you deploy as a very small shop. I mean, you're part of a big brigade, but you don't have a platoon like most soldiers do, you know, who go over with a group of 20 or 30, you know, a whole company and stuff. We kind of went over in our little tiny group and kind of hung in our group. And then I had to go off. Each time I went on a new mission, I'm going out with a whole new group of platoon, a whole new platoon, and a whole, new trucks and new people and new, and so I had to kind of like navigate that with a lot of humility, because I'm starting to walk. First of all, public affairs, even in the military, you're not always trusted. Everybody kind of wants to keep just a little bit of hands off, because especially if it's outside media is really untrusted in the military. But we were public affairs, so we could never do anything that would, like, you know, show something that would hurt a unit or hurt individuals or anything like that. So I had a lot of restrictions on what I was capable of even filming as a public affairs person. But each time I went out with another group of people, I had to earn their trust. What did it feel like when I got there? I think I kind of, looking back, I was really, I don't know if it was naive to death, because I hadn't been around much death. I think I've been to a couple funerals, and I had up to that point, I think I saw a couple people die when I was doing homeless work in downtown Skid Row. I think that was the first time I saw somebody like OD, but like, was I afraid of death? I don't know if I was. I kind of was just like a young, gung-ho kid who kind of could always talk my way out of going down the wrong side of the street. Or like, if I ended up in the wrong neighborhood, I could weasel my way out of stuff. Maybe I'm a tall white dude. I don't know. I think sometimes I just could weasel my way out of stuff. And I wasn't afraid of dying. And I had a lot of advantages, you know, than some of these people that joined. Like, I had gotten a bachelor's degree already. I had gotten married, you know, and now I'm out here on the front lines with 18, 19, 20 year olds who have way less to lose than I do. So I was kind of just, and it was, what a lot of soldiers say until shit goes down is that it was, you know, it's fun. We're doing our job. We're out there trying to help people. We're on edge. And then I think it's later on in life you realize, oh, maybe I was a lot more afraid of death than I thought. All of this stuff gets, all this trauma gets stored in your body. And then later in life, we're like, oh man, I think I have some issues with what went down. But when I was there, I was, of course, though, you're always on edge and you're always like something could happen and there is fear. I mean, anybody who says that they're not afraid at wars, you know, I mean, I think I was less afraid of dying than I was than getting injured or getting something. I mean, because now I was spending time in the hospital seeing what war is really like. It's not.
And just, you ended up in the hospital, right?
I mean, I did a documentary in the hospital, so I was never wounded or anything. But there was a hospital on that base that you showed, Salerno, and it was one of the biggest combat hospitals, kind of like MASH. It was like a MASH hospital, and it was. I mean, every time we had casualties coming in all the time, and I spent a lot of time in there doing a film, you know, interviewing them, spending time. When there was a casualty call, I'd go. And so, yeah.
And the base you were at rockets were fired at it on a regular basis. So it wasn't like it was a calm environment where you were. I mean, it was a war environment. There was constant war going on. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, so combat, so there's like different levels of bases, right? So this was forward operating base Salerno, which had like a you could land a C-130 or a big airplane on it. You could, the special forces had their compound on it. We had a brigade headquarters and we had like tons of trucks and a canine unit that was there, EOD. So it was a huge base. And even so, we're getting rockets and mortars and stuff all the time. You know, we'd react to it as soon as it would start to happen and squash it. But, you know, a couple times a week, sometimes we'd have them, you know, there's a couple times it lasted several hours in the middle of the night. You just sit in the bunker. And then it was like, obviously, once you go off that base, it gets more dangerous because all of that can happen outside the wire. And then you're going to like, then I started going to these smaller combat outposts. That were, you know, 1-2 platoon sized outposts that are kind of in the middle of Afghanistan. And the only way to get there was either long ground transport that takes forever because you're trying to avoid hitting IEDs, or the fastest, most efficient way that we traveled in Afghanistan was helicopters, Chinooks, Blackhawks. Yeah.
Well, there's so much. There's so much to get into, you know, in your experience in Afghanistan. But one part of it was you built relationships, and it leads to, and we're going to talk about your film Interpreters Wanted. But you built relationships with interpreters who were such a vital part of allowing you to be able to do what the military does over there, to communicate, to be safe. All the elements. These interpreters were so vital to your efforts, and you built relationships with them. Tell us about that. How did that start to develop? Tell the people what is that, and who are these people who become interpreters in Afghan, you know, because they're risking their lives. Share a little bit about that journey, and then we're going to get into watching the trailer for the movie, and then you'll take us deeper.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're really excited about this film, Interpreters Wanted. 14 years it took me to finish it, you know. Wow. And thanks for watching it and talking about it today. You know, it's my vision of going, and I say a lot of this in the film because the film is about my relationship with Saifullah and Ishmael. Those were my interpreters that were part of our public affairs shop when we were in Afghanistan. And we did, yeah, there he is, Saifullah, both before and after. And Saifullah and his brothers. Ishmael is on the left there with his glasses, and Saifullah is the third. And wonderful brothers of mine now. And but, you know, when I go back to the moment that I first saw Saifullah, you know, I had probably my first real interaction with Muslims was when I went to Afghanistan, Israel, and started talking with Palestinians, both, you know, Muslim Palestinians, Christian Palestinians, Christians that were, Arabic or spoke Arabic and were from other cultures and stuff. And I don't think I ever met or talked to a Muslim though in America. And so my perception was, as a lot of people's was after 9/11, and especially when you're preparing to go to war in Afghanistan, you have no idea. I had no idea what I was getting myself into and who these people were, what they were about, or Afghan culture, what language they spoke. I mean, we had introductory classes for the average soldier. Like, we would go through PowerPoint and they'd say, they'd explain all of this when we're coming into country. But it wasn't like, you know, a course at a university, or it wasn't like very deep. It was a surface level to give us, but we're anxious to go fight and go, we're here to fight a war. But really, the strategy we were using in Afghanistan was called counterinsurgency. And the main thrust of it was like winning the hearts and minds of the people. And so it was absolutely integral that we had these interpreters that were incorporated into all of our different units. So because I was in a public affairs shop, you know, so you had like different levels of interpreters. I mean, you'd have interpreters that would go out on the front lines all the time. And that's like Ishmael was the younger brother of the two. And he would go out all the time on the front lines. And then because we were at a brigade level and we're communicating with the Afghan governments, we're communicating with major media in back home and in Afghanistan, like we had to have a top intelligent interpreter at the brigade level to go through all of our communications, our media, our what we were sending out into the world, our press releases, helping guide CNN or Fox News or MSNBC, who's coming in with cultural advice and translating stuff for them. And so Saifullah basically lived with us at the public affairs shop. And when I first saw him, I didn't know what to think about him. I didn't know what there was always like rumors of interpreters turning, or we didn't know if they were vetted enough, or like, and it was just the angst of, you know, being in war. But over time, Saifullah and Ishmael and myself became very, very good friends. You know, we were in mortar attacks together. I knew about their families. I know how dangerous it was for them to even get to the base, that the Taliban were after anybody that was helping the Americans. And then you started to realize, boy, we can't do anything in this country without them, that these people are not only on our side, but willing to give it all up for what they believe is a better way for their country. You know, and so we just formed a very deep relationship.
Well, you know, in the future, I'd love to do a show on so many different elements of the Afghan country and the war. And you cover so much, a small piece in the documentary, but, you know, Afghans had a long, long history, and it's been occupied by a lot of people. It's fought all those occupiers out. But it always wasn't the same. And the Taliban was a new version. I mean, it was Muslim, but the Taliban was a special version that was really radical and dictatorial and you know, a worse version. I mean, so the Afghan people had a country. They had a democracy of their version, or at least a peaceful society. And then, of course, the Soviet Union occupied them. And you talk about some of this in that. And so it is that piece of it, then America's war, and then America's retreat. And there's just so much to go into. Someday I'd love to have a couple of documentary filmmakers like yourself, like a panel, then you can share all that stuff so everybody can learn, including me. But I think that's something for the future I want to do. But tell us a little bit about that, because you saw it with these interpreters. You know, their lives were at risk. I mean, they were stepping up in a way because they loved their country. They loved their families. And they were brave people. They were brave people who were, you know, doing a great job because they believed in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you showed one of the last clips of the film that says, you know, this film is dedicated to the Afghan people. And I said, I wanted to end the film with that because we met so many wonderful, amazing people there. And, you know, when you're coming from a very, very first world experience like I had, you know, I was a lower middle class. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, which was like, you know, I had the problems that a lot of kids did back then too, but nothing like the third world that Afghan, you know, the poverty, the level of poverty that we saw there, the level of pain and suffering. I mean, the, like, you know, we'd walk through villages and I'm like, we would joke about disciples coming around the corner, like it was the, you know, the Roman times, during Jesus's times. Like it was, I mean, there was areas where they had no running water, no electricity. And the Taliban, you know, I think one of the things that there's a lot of things to talk about in the 20-year war of Afghanistan. That's an ancient culture that's been around since, you know, Alexander the Great couldn't even, we lost there.
Yeah.
You know, it's an ancient society, ancient area of the world. And yeah, I mean, walking around there and seeing it and experiencing it as an American sometimes was a little surreal. And I just felt sorry for the people. And the Taliban, you know, were a really good bad guy for us to fight for 20 years. I mean, I think that they are exactly everything that you said. I mean, they're probably the worst version of Islam. They're the most radical, brutalized. They're uneducated. They hate education. They're very, you know, they're the most radical version of like what men do to oppress women or cultures do to oppress women. So it was really easy for us to want to fight them for a long time because look at what they're, I mean, I interviewed a girl who had acid thrown on her face, you know.
Wow.
And guys like Saifullah and Ismail loathed the Taliban because their father, who was very Western, who was educated, who was, you know, lived in the major cities and wanted to educate his children and all that stuff. Like he was oppressed by the Taliban. And we talk about this in the film. He was blown up in a car and he lost his feet because of the Taliban. Like these were horribly radicalized people that are, you know, that a lot of them, Saifullah and Ismail would say, are even coming in from Pakistan. So, you know, the war creates this kind of chaotic cycle that allows, you know, I don't know. I think it's impossible. I think we're going to be talking and trying to figure out the Afghan war for a long time, to say the least.
Yeah, and I think your film deals, or at least touches on some of that, because like, once again, you know, I think one of, I think it was Ismail who speaks about it, about just that, you know, people, we came in and this was always the problem and didn't come in and listen to the people and find out what they wanted or how to help them solve the problem, as opposed to coming in with all the answers. And of course, some of the answers might've been good, but a lot were wrong. And so not doing that. So you addressed that. So I think maybe this is a good time to just go over and let's look at the trailer. And then we'll come back and we'll start talking about it some more. And then we'll talk about your journey. How did you get to make this documentary? Because like you said, 14 years. So from 2010 to now to get this made. So let's go take a look at, let me just jump it up. And I will show this. Here we go. Coming up.
The Taliban is now effectively in control, including in the capital, Kabul.
Thousands of Afghans eligible for visas because they had worked for the U.S. were left behind.
Getting out of the country to safety here in the state has been a long and difficult process.
I never thought when I went to Afghanistan that I would be telling the story of an Afghan, but war gives you a perspective about people.
My name is Saifullah Akhmal. I work for the U.S. Army in Afghanistan.
This is the first chance I have to speak out, to tell all the untold stories.
There's a bond with interpreters and soldiers.
The interpreters were like the eyes for the U.S. military in Afghanistan.
It's a death sentence to work with the U.S. as an interpreter.
The insurgent would all the time say, kill those ears and eyes, cut that, and then there will be nothing.
I never assumed that when I go out on a mission, I'll come back alive. We knew several interpreters were shot and killed. Innocent people, they were killing them like chickens.
My life was in a great danger, and I wanted to come to the United States to live a free life.
It took years for our interpreters to finally get their visas, because there are a thousand stories of these guys.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan.
This is the end. We're going to get out by September 11th.
This is our village, and we left everything behind. We are heading down to Kabul.
My whole family were there, so exhausted, no water, no food, and so many people. It was really dangerous.
I was leaving somebody behind, and we were leaving a lot of people behind.
Three hours later, there was an explosion.
This hour with breaking news, and it's difficult.
U.S. withdrawal of forces after nearly 20 years.
Afghanistan.
The war in Afghanistan.
It's time for American troops to come home.
I want to take my kids to the United States. The future is very uncertain and unknown.
Wow. I just watched it yesterday, and I just want to tell everybody, I hope as many people possible. I just watched it last night, and I hope a lot of people get a chance to see it. The more people, the better. I mean, there's just so much in it, man. And congratulations. You did a fantastic job on every level, both the documentary, but even more important, somebody, I was at a play the other night, and somebody said the main thing is to be a good human. And I took away from that, and I think that's what you were, because you left Afghanistan in 2010. Is that correct? And then you went on with your life, and yet somehow you finally stayed in touch, and then you were engaged to help them get out. So tell us that story. I mean, you could have forgot about it. You could have walked away from it. You could have put it in your past. You could have said, I can't do anything, but you didn't. Why?
Well, like I said, I'm kind of a stubborn. I'm stubborn. And I also, when you go into the, you know, one of the values of the military is never leave someone behind, you know. And I truly remember when I say a lot of this in the film. And I didn't really want to put myself in the film, to be honest. It kind of worked out that way, because I think there needed to be some kind of like almost a narration kind of to piece it together. But it was also partially my story. In retrospect, I think it was a way for me to share my love and affection for Saiful and Ishmael. You know, when he left, when I was leaving, Saiful looked at me and he said, you know, your deployment in Afghanistan is coming to an end, but I fear mine will never end. Like those words kind of haunted me, because what I believed about America and what I believed about our mission there, or just our mission in the world, is just because that's how I try to live my life, is like finish the mission, you know, finish what you start and do it the best that you can. But I'm not, what happens for a lot of veterans when they come home is there is this guilt that we couldn't finish the mission, and now we're stuck with this burden of not finishing that mission, whether it was Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, or whatever it is. And it's like, this was my way of trying to continue to fulfill my obligation to that country and those people. But it was also very human and very like personal for me, because these were friends now. I mean, these are like friends being chased by the worst people in the world. And I'm now getting Facebook messages while I'm going to USC film school that this is an active ongoing thing. Just because I came back from the war and now I'm in America, the war is still real, and it's still real for me, and it was still real for them. So, you know, they started reaching out on Facebook, and then that's when it was a slow process, and just thank God they didn't get killed during that process, because it was like that burden me to try to do something that I didn't have any power to fix. I couldn't fix the bureaucracy of how long it took. I couldn't fix the laws that were prohibiting interpreters to get to America. I couldn't fix the fact that we had a very, you know, in the film, you know, I'm very careful to talk politics because of everything that politics brings, but it's hard to avoid talking politics when it comes to war. Afghanistan, because it is political, but Afghanistan is a very interesting war in that it was four administrations, actually even goes before that, which I talk about, you know, President Clinton attacked Afghanistan prior to 9/11. We've been involved in watching and being a part of Afghanistan far before that with our involvement with, you know, the Mujahideen in the 90s and or the 80s and all the things. So, you know, just to throw this at one administration, I think is unfair. I think kind of like now we've had four administrations, four different policies, four different ways of doing things. And that I think is probably consistent with why Afghanistan ended up the way that it did. But one thing that should be that needs to be consistent, no matter what you feel about the war, no matter where you land on it, is like, we need to help Afghan interpreters because they were there for us, you know? And so that's how I felt. And that's what I tried to pursue.
Well, just to go a little bit further, because yes, I agree. And I think you're right in that, because they served you and your thing about not leaving anybody behind, and they became your brothers, and to not leave them behind was a noble and a honorable thing to do, which is what we should always do, right? Sometimes our country gets it wrong, but it should get it right, because that's what, you know, you should do. That's the correct thing to do. But even for, you know, like in the movie too, and like I said, I hope everybody gets a chance to watch it, and I'll ask you about where they can see it, and we'll get into that in a little bit later. But even the people, I mean, there was probably good things done by our efforts over there, and there was things not so good done. And the good things clearly were, and they talk about it, the two brothers, but just the education of the people, the freeing of women, giving women a chance to get educated. There was a lot of at least good things put in motion that unfortunately did not finish, never got to the point where it really changed the world for the people of Afghanistan, unfortunately. But you saw some of that, because that was part of the effort too, was to try to make things better for those people.
Yeah. There's a segment that I'm proud of and is also tragic in the film where, you know, during my deployment, we would go out and we would literally hand out bread and food and water to like basically starving children. And we'd have like donations that were coming in from America of clothes and food and snacks and just all sorts of stuff. And we'd put it all, we'd have a hospital and we'd occupy this whole space and we'd have all these clothes set out. And we'd have American doctors and Afghan doctors checking on these kids and giving them medicine and then getting them clothes and sending them back out to Afghanistan. And yeah, in retrospect, it's kind of a band-aid on the horrible stuff. But these were real experiences for us, the soldiers on the ground. You know, these were real experiences. Like, I think when we as a collective veteran, and I don't speak for any other veteran except for myself, but now with all the experience I have coming home and talking with a lot of veterans and stuff, I think most of us went there with the right intentions to help people and I would say this in Iraq and Afghanistan, that we went there to help the people because, you know, they also wanted help, and there's many that wanted help and there's many that wanted, and yet I think, you know, sometimes on a larger political scale, we should talk about what we're capable of doing and what we should be doing. But in the moments, in the day-to-day, I mean, I saw heroic men and women who are on the front lines sacrificing their individual life and body and treasure and future, you know, trauma for the people of Afghanistan. And they did the same. Afghan soldiers we fought alongside that were good, and there were many, sacrificed a lot. And there are a lot of good educators. There are a lot of good professors. There are a lot of, and you know, those were typically the first ones that the Taliban would try to kill, are the best. I did a film called The Best of Us while I was in Afghanistan. And it was literally about how the Taliban tried to target the best of that society first. Because once you kill the educated, the good ones, then you're left with just ones that could become, you know, that you could now insert your power and your violence to get your way with the rest of the people. Yeah.
Well, I know from my life, I mean, that was true in Cambodia under the Pol Pot regime, and it was the same thing. By wiping out the educated people who had glasses, because if you wore glasses, you were probably educated. By wiping out the educated class, then they could dominate and you know, keep people from thinking and reading and learning. So the communists did it in Cambodia. And so Taliban's just a different religious version of it as well. But, you know, the horrors of that. But I think just your point, I just want to just echo your point. No matter what we all see, whatever the politics are from what each is, whatever side, the bottom line is all the sacrifice of the American military who put their lives over there to do a good thing. I hope nobody forgets that, because they didn't decide the politics. They didn't decide why we're there. They went and they served and they risked their lives and they tried to do the best they could. That's something I hope we take away, as well as the Afghans who helped us, that we don't forget that's the good part of what this was all about. And the other things we'll have to judge over time. But I think that's what you got. And then, you know, tell us a little bit about the journey, because it wasn't easy to get out of Afghanistan, even though they were promised that they could get out. It didn't go the way. At one point, there was like so many people, translators, interpreters trying to get out, and only like three got out in 1 year. And it was just a nightmare bureaucracy that the U.S. government created that made it almost impossible. So tell us a little bit about that without getting into everything, but.
Yeah. Cause I made a film that's as long winded as I could be. So, you know,
but,
yeah.
Go ahead, man.
So Saifullah got to, you know, to be an interpreter around 2004, 2005, which is already the war is going on for a few years. By the time I get there, he's 2009, 2010. He's already done 5-6 years of service to trying to get, and it's like, what is the progress? Are we going to either look like we're starting to win the war, or are we going to withdraw and kind of like pull out? And that was like, Saifullah and Ismail didn't really know what the future of Afghanistan was, and they already put in so much time. And so by the time we were there, Saifullah and Ismail decided it's time to maybe start making that move to America. We did our time. We don't want to get killed. We don't want our family to get killed. Let's, you know, pass it on to somebody else, and we'll come back maybe when the war is over. It didn't work out that way. You know, once we left in 2009, 2010, the war continued, and Saifullah and Ismail kind of kept working until 2012, 2013, when we started to withdraw our troops, because the Obama administration basically came in 2009, 10 and said, we're going to do a surge with a 2-year kind of like cap on that surge. And then we're going to start to withdraw troops. Once we started withdrawing those troops, bases started to shut down, and Saifullah and Ismail basically had zero resources. I mean, they didn't have jobs anymore. They also, all of the people that cared about them and worked with them had gone back to the United States. And now Saifullah and Ismail are stuck in Afghanistan, and they're trying to figure out how the hell do we get out. So they started reaching out to me on Facebook, and I started working with them to get their case through to Congress people, because if we could start getting their case number in front of enough congressional seats, then their name goes higher on the list. And that was kind of the only way to break through the bureaucracy, because what you said earlier, in 2009, 2010, Congress was allowing up to 1,500, I think my numbers might be off, it's in the film, but I think it was like 1,500 visas a year or something. And they only were given, the only actual number was like 3 Afghans that got to America, because they were starting to stonewall people because we needed them, because we're continuing the war. So, you know, as Saifullah and Ismail are realizing that they're not going to get out, they became desperate. Eventually we, you know, I don't want to give too much of the film away, but the good news is by 2016, we got Saifullah back. By 2018, we got Ismail to America. Both of them, to America. But I think the story gets more fascinating in the film, because Ismail ends up going back to Afghanistan during COVID to help his family and gets stuck there during the withdrawal. And that's the whole end of the film follows Ishmael's journey through the withdrawal.
Yeah, and that's such a powerful segment, and people really definitely got to watch the film for everything. But, you know, here's just a very iconic picture people remember of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and also 13 U.S. service people killed by a terrorist during that evacuation. And he's over there with his family. And like you said, in the middle of that madness, chaos, and who knows how, what it's going to turn out. So they got to watch the film. It's so powerful. Every bit of it is so powerful in the way, you know, that you see what is happening. It was one of the stronger points for me watching it, you know, because I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, you don't know. And how is it going to get resolved? And it's, but, you know, once again, you stayed in touch. You decided to, obviously, you created that bond. And that's the other reason I recommend the film too, is just to kind of, it's like, it's the better angels in us that, you know, you were able to create that bond with these two Afghanis who, you know, didn't have anything in common with a guy from the Valley. And yet they did. And your humanity was your common thing, and your experience together, and you brought that brotherhood, you know, forward in life. And I think that's something that we can all take away and inspire all of us to live better and do better. So I'm so glad I got to see the film. I wish I got to see it at the festival, but oh well, I still got to see it. So
thank you for that. And you know, Saiful and Ishmael are my heroes. I mean, and to see what they're doing now, they're both here in America now with their families, and they're hard workers. I mean, they take pride in being hard workers, and they take pride in paying taxes, and they take pride in being good people and doing the things that they're doing to raise their families, and they're good contributing people.
Share here, or we just want to wait till people see it. Two things that they're doing. If you want me to share it, I'll share that.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is one, I think this is just a great moment in 2022, which is just mind boggling.
Yeah. You know, Justin Platt is the gentleman in the top, and he was really also, unfortunately, you know, we didn't really have space in the film to talk about him, but he was also a big part in helping Saifullah get here and get his citizenship. And, you know, Saifullah is loved by many, many soldiers because he was there. I mean, he was there for a decade, you know, and I know people that are good friends of mine that I served with separately from Afghanistan that served with Saifullah. You know, he's well known, and it was just a tragic thing that happened. And to see there, talk about living courageously, you know, and living with a purpose. And, you know, boy, Saifullah and Ishmael are wonderful heroes, in my opinion. So.
Yeah, and then this is just another picture that Ishmael continues to advocate in America for Afghans' freedom from the Taliban. So that's just another, once again, you know, his commitment to his people and wanting to have a free Afghanistan. So it's...
that's a beautiful thing about America. You know, I think that's what I look back and I remember what we all felt. Well, how I felt on 9/12, and I think a lot of people felt, is what you were talking to earlier. It's just that maybe we've been taking this amazing experience of a country for granted. Like this moment on 9/12, we are all one people, and it doesn't matter your race or religion or creed or whatever, as long as you're an American. And that's how Saifullah and Ishmael feel now. I mean, you know, I do think it's Ishmael would love to move back to Afghanistan one day, as he said, and even Saifullah would too. I think they're both not very hopeful that things will change there, but they are Americans now. And Saifullah has been wanting that. His kids, you know, when he had his son born, his fourth child was born in America, you know, and they're grateful to be here. And it humbles me as someone who's a third generation. You know, my mom and dad, my mom's Armenian. My great grandma was a genocide survivor, came here as an immigrant, you know, and we all pretty much come here at one stage or another as immigrants, and to see their appreciation and love for this country also invigorates my desire to try to make it a better country too.
Well, I think the same with me. You know, my parents came from Ireland. I'm first generation American, and I went down to the World Trade Center in December of that year, 2001, and it was still smoking, and all the people were up with the flowers and all the things, remembering their people. And it was, for me, the most emotional moment I ever had in my life. And I seeing people come, I'm a New Yorker, and seeing New Yorkers come together, it was just the amount of love that was being exhibited by the humans in New York for each other. to me, that was the highlight. Out of the horror and the negative came that beauty and that love and the fact that people knew that they were in it together. And that to me was one of the greater moments. And, you know, hopefully we'll get some more of those back as we go forward in life. But, you know, I think that's what it did to me, at least.
Yeah. I mean, I wish that we could unite like that without having something so horrible happen to remind us about how we're all human, you know? And I think, again, we were all New Yorkers and we were all Americans that day, because I was 18, still collected comic books and action figures, watching from my little TV in Los Angeles. And man, you know, I had gone to New York with my dad. He had been playing music for Promise Keepers way back in the, and we went when we were like, we went over there and he played in one, I think the Mets stadium or something. And I was 16 and I went to the top of the towers. And then 2 years later, you know, so I had just a little bit of a sneak of what New York was, but just from a very outside, but man, special. That was there's a special resilience and grit that comes with being a New Yorker, I think.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, obviously California's home now, but, you know, I'll always be I'm a kid from the South Bronx. That's what I, you know, I'll always be. So that's my identity and I'll never lose that, man. I'm cool with that. But tell me, you know, how people get to see Interpreters Wanted. Where do they see it? How do they see it? What are the plans that you have for it? Any more festivals? Is it going to be streaming? You know, what's the way for people to be able to watch this very, very powerful film? And I recommend. And of course, people can go to your website and see a lot of your work. And there's a lot of your work on there. And that's hammerproductions.com. It's up on the screen. People can go there and just see what you've done. And there's so much more that you've done. But I recommend people to check it out. How do they do that?
Yeah. So we are partnered with Veteran TV. Basically, they came on towards the end of the film and gave me the rest of the funds to finish this bad boy. Super thankful to them. You know, they are a content streamer, you know, very, very much towards the active duty veteran grunt on the ground. So, you know, they have a lot of great, and their documentaries are really great. And so, that will be airing on their streamers first, August 26th. So just a few more weeks. I think I would just like follow, we're going to start promoting it here in the next couple of weeks. And so that's the first place, and we're hoping for wider distribution after that. But we're, you know, right now, Hollywood, as you probably know, is going through some major transitions. And I would love to get this movie in front of some of the other big streamers, but and thankful that it's going to start with the veteran community at Vet TV and will make itself out further after that. So August 26th is the wide release on Vet TV.
Now, have you considered, I don't know if you can, doing a screening of it at the American Legion Post 43 in Hollywood that I'm a member. I think you're a member there too, maybe. But I mean, they got that great 450 seat theater sitting there. It would be great to be able to do a screening of this movie there for everybody.
I would love to. I haven't talked with them yet, but I'm a member of, and I should. I was just talking with some of them a couple months ago. Actually, I talked with them about this film because I was trying to get people to come to the Dances with Films, which was our last film festival that was here in Los Angeles. So we're wrapped up at film festivals, and I would love, the more, you know, one thing that I've experienced as we've been going on these festivals is watching it in a room with people is what we strive for as filmmakers. There's something that connects us, you know, people laugh together, people cry together, people, you know, are shocked together. And watching in a room, particularly with veterans, but anybody, I mean, we've watched it now with some Afghans, you know, who have loved the film. So I think it's, you know, for me, it's been such an ongoing thing. I'm kind of on to the next thing. But also, I'm ready for people to get this, to see this. So I think I would love to show it at American.
Well, if you need me to reach out to anybody, Dennis over there, the commando, anybody else, I mean, I would recommend that they definitely show it there. I think it would be a major hit. I think people would love it. So it'd be just another way to reach an audience that would love and appreciate what you did with the story. So I'm definitely a fan. So if there's anything I can do to help you, let me know.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And then just to wrap up, and this is it, interpreters wanted, of course, and they can go, and you said August 26th, FET TV, and then you can go to your website to get more information, and people can track you there and follow you there on hammerproductions.com. Wrapping up, anything you would like to leave us with? I mean, there's so much more. I mean, I can't believe an hour's over. It's like, I got at least another hour's worth of material to talk to you about, but what would you like to leave us with? Any what's upcoming for you, future plans, what you're working on, and then just any takeaways for us to leave the show with?
Yeah, thanks. I get super passionate about talking about Sci-Fi and Ishmael, and I could do it for hours, and so I tried to wrap it up in my 84 minute documentary that thanks for plugging all that. Right now, my day job is I do a lot of different films for the Veterans Administration Hospital. So I am a subcontractor, and I directed over 100 different videos of a whole bunch of different programs that they have, cancer care. We just did a scripted film, short film for the VA about trying to get better access for women in the veteran, so the VA is really trying to change some of the things that have gone wrong before, trying to adapt to a lot of the stuff that challenges that have come with from all these wars, and a lot of the challenges of having a big bureaucracy as a hospital. And so I'm very proud of the work I'm doing at the VA. I'm also I'm doing another documentary about a lawsuit that's going on with the VA right now. It's veterans suing the VA about homelessness. That's happening literally right now. The case is ongoing in Los Angeles. CNN has been covering it. So I have a feature documentary I'm working on with that. And then I have my next film that will be coming out probably next year is called Zaslow K427. And it's about 9/11. Ira Zaslow was a man who was killed on 9/11 in the towers. He worked for an oil company, and he was a New Yorker. And his son Adam was 23 when he watched the towers fall, and went on this journey of discovery of trying to find the answers to, just now, what does he do with life after this? And stumbles upon a woman who was taking care of a dog named Zaslow K427, who was named after Ira, and was part of the TSA puppy program. And that dog, Zaslow, ends up becoming the longest tenured canine in post 9/11 history, with his canine handler, Juan Estrada, who is a Puerto Rican who served in the military. And they did 3 deployments to Afghanistan. And it's just like this beautiful story of just grief and trials, but also like the spirit of what dogs can do to help us get through this, and the amazing, I mean, this dog was like a mind detection dog. And so it's a great story, very New York. So I've spent a lot of time in New York now doing this doc and about 9/11 and stuff. So I feel very kindred spirit. So that's the next film, and just grinding, doing my thing, you know?
Well, all those sound good. I look forward, congratulations with your journey on all that. And I look forward to that. Sounds like a really, very cool story, man. So I wish you luck with it, and can't wait to see it. Any other closing thoughts? Otherwise, once again, thank you, Robert. Tell everybody to go watch Interpreters on August 26th. They can definitely check it out on your website, Hammer Productions, and definitely go watch it and support it, share it, and do whatever you can. It's a great project, and it'll touch your heart. Let's put it that way. It touched mine, and I hope it'll touch the audience's hearts as well. So any closing thoughts beyond that? And once again, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for making the film. Thank you for being who you are.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you. The same to you, and I appreciate this opportunity. Yeah, I mean, I'm on social media. Subscribe to my email list on my website. Stay in touch. Follow the work, and I just appreciate, I appreciate the view. I appreciate the watch, and I think you're right. Let's live courageously together,
Sounds good, man. Well, I'm going to close out the show. And once again, thank you so much, Robert. Thank you, brother, for being part of it. Well, everybody, thank you. Thank you for coming to another episode of Live Courageously. And I hope you join us every Sunday at 6 p.m. To see. And if you want to see my previous 81 podcast shows with some of the amazing courageous friends sharing their powerful stories, you can watch them on live-courageously.com on my website, or Live Courageously on my YouTube channel. And then join me every Sunday at 6 p.m. to have another powerful show with another courageous friend and guest of mine. Until I see you then, take care and God bless.